All right, so get this.
Oh.
Imagine you just won this huge lawsuit, right?
Huge, yeah.
But the defendant, they're not happy. So they decide, okay, we're going to appeal this thing. But then there's this crazy twist. A state law comes out of nowhere and it wants to actually punish the loser of the appeal, even though the case is like happening in federal court.
Oh, wow.
Talk about a legal headache, right?
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of legal drama that we saw unfold in Burlington Northern Railroad v. Woods.
Okay.
This case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the justices had to figure out this really tricky question. Can a state law actually control what happens in federal court, especially when there's already a federal rule that deals with the exact same issue? It's a real jurisdictional tug of war.
So before we, dive into all the legal complexities of this case,
Sure.
can you kind of set the stage for us? Like, what even led to this whole showdown in the first place?
All right, so picture this. It's Alabama in the 1980s. Alan and Kara Woods, they get injured in a motorcycle accident.
Oh
And
no.
they decide, you know what? We're going to sue. Their case ends up going to federal court because of what's called diversity jurisdiction. Basically, it means the people involved in the case are from different states.
Gotcha. So I'm guessing the Woods, they won their case, right?
They did. The jury sided with them. Alan was awarded $300,000, and Kara got $5,000.
Wow.
But Burlington Northern, that was the defendant, they weren't happy with this verdict at all.
Yeah.
They decided, we're going to appeal this thing. And this is where that Alabama law we talked about earlier, it comes into play.
Okay, this is where it starts to get interesting. So what did this Alabama law actually say, and why did it become such a big problem?
So this Alabama law, it had this kind of unusual provision in it. It basically said that anyone who appeals a judgment and loses, they have to pay a 10% penalty on top of everything else.
Really?
Yeah, think of it like a loser pays system,
Okay.
but with an extra sting. The Woods saw this and thought, hey, we can use this to get even more money if Burlington Northern loses their appeal.
Yeah, I bet Burlington Northern was not thrilled about that. I
Yeah.
mean, they were kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, right?
Right.
Appeal the verdict and maybe end up having to pay even more
Exactly.
or just accept the initial judgment.
Yep. It was a tough spot. But wait, there's another twist.
Okay, there's always another twist.
There's this federal rule. It's called FRP 38. And this rule gives federal courts the power to decide whether to award damages for appeals that they consider frivolous. So now we have a direct conflict. You've got the mandatory penalty from the Alabama law, but then you have this more flexible approach under FRP 38.
So we've got state law versus federal rule,
Yeah.
both trying to deal with, the same issue. This must have been a real challenge for the Supreme Court to sort out. How did they even approach this legal puzzle?
Well, the Supreme Court, they turned to a framework that was established in an earlier case called Hanna v. Plummer. You can think of Hanna v. Plummer like a guidebook for figuring out what happens when state and federal laws clash.
Okay, so like a legal roadmap.
Exactly. So how did this roadmap, how did it help the Supreme Court decide between the Alabama law and FRAP 38? Well, it helped them see the conflict more clearly, you know. And they ultimately decided that in this case, the state law, it had to give way to the federal rule. They said that FRAP 38, as a federal rule about court procedures, was meant to make sure that things are consistent and fair in federal courts. It shouldn't matter which state the case comes from.
Right, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, imagine if every state had their own set of rules for federal court.
It'd be chaos.
Yeah, total chaos. It wouldn't be fair at all. But hold on, didn't Burlington Northern also try to argue that the Alabama law was like unconstitutional?
They did. They brought up some constitutional arguments. They said that Alabama's law violated the 14th Amendment, but the Supreme Court, they kind of sidestepped those arguments. They decided to resolve the whole thing using that existing legal framework from Hanna v. Plummer.
So they focused on like the practical part of the problem,
Yeah.
the clash between the state and federal rules.
Exactly.
And they found a solution within that framework without having to get into all
Yeah.
the messy constitutional questions.
Exactly.
Smart move. So this case, it's more than just a motorcycle accident, right?
Oh, yeah.
It brings up some really fundamental questions about the balance of power between state and federal courts.
Absolutely. And we're just scratching the surface here. There's a lot more to unpack in this case.
Wow, this case is it's really kind of eye-opening. You've got state laws, federal rules, and then there's that whole framework from Hanna v. Plummer. It's like a legal puzzle with all these different
Yeah, it definitely.
pieces.
To really see how it all fits together, we need to look at something called the Rules Enabling Act.
Okay.
A lot of times people shorten that to REA.
REA, got it.
This act's a big deal when it comes to how federal courts handle their procedures.
So what does the REA actually do? And how did it, you know, affect the Supreme Court's decision in Burlington Northern?
Basically, the REA gives the Supreme Court the power to create the procedural rules that federal courts have to follow. It's kind of like Congress saying to the court, you guys are the experts in running the court, so you get to decide how the game is played.
So it's about consistency, right?
Mm-hmm.
And making sure the federal courts are, you know, running smoothly.
Exactly. But there's a really important catch. The REA also says that these federal procedural rules can't mess with any substantive rights.
Okay, so what does that even mean? Substantive rights.
It means that the federal rules can't change the basic rights and obligations that are laid out by state law.
Ah, so it's like a balancing act, right?
Right.
Federal rules can make things more efficient, but they can't go too far and actually change what the law itself says. And a lot of times, that law comes from the states.
Exactly. And this is where Burlington Northern gets really interesting. The court had to look at FRP 38, that federal rule about penalties for pointless appeals, and decide if it was a legit procedural rule under the REA.
And I'm assuming they decided it was, right? Because they ended up siding with the federal rule over the Alabama law.
You got it. The court said that FRP 38 was all about procedure. It deals with how the courts handle appeals, not with the actual right to appeal, which is considered a substantive right.
So can I, like, use an analogy here?
Sure.
It's like, FRP 38 is setting the rules for a basketball game.
Okay.
It tells you how the game is played, but it doesn't change the fact that you're playing basketball. The actual rules of basketball, those are separate.
I like that. That's a great analogy.
Okay, good. So FRI 38 sets up the ground rules for appeals, but it doesn't mess with the basic rights and liabilities that were set by state law in the original case. I think I'm starting to see the bigger picture now. This case wasn't just about some penalty in one specific case. It was about keeping that balance between federal procedural rules and state substantive law.
You hit the nail on the head, and that balance is super important. It's what makes our dual court system work, with state and federal courts operating side by side. Burlington Northern made it very clear that federal courts have the power to set their own procedures, but they can't step on state substantive rights while doing it.
It really shows how connected everything is in our legal system. It's fascinating, but I bet it can be a real headache for lawyers who have to deal with all these tiny details. Any advice for our listeners on how to, you know, avoid running into these kinds of conflicts?
Yeah, the main thing is when you're dealing with a case that falls under diversity jurisdiction, always, and I mean always, watch out for potential clashes between state and federal procedural rules. Thorough research is your best friend.
So do your homework and be aware of the possible traps. That's good advice. But let's be real. Sometimes even the best lawyers can miss these subtle conflicts. What happens then? Are there ways to fix it?
Of course. If a conflict does come up, courts have different ways to handle it. One common approach is to see if the federal rule is broad enough to cover the issue. If it is, then it usually wins over the state rule.
Like a legal game of King of the Hill, where the federal rule is king if it clearly controls the area in question.
Yeah, you could think of it that way. But courts also look at whether using the federal rule would really change the outcome of the case. If it would, then they might try to accommodate the state rule, you know, to make things fairer.
So it's not always a slam dunk for the federal rule. There's room for judgment calls and looking at the specifics of each case.
Exactly. Judges aren't robots. They look at all the facts of the case and try to find a solution that's both fair and just.
This deep dive has really shown me how complicated federalism is and how state and federal law work together. It's a reminder that things are always changing in the law, and lawyers have to stay up to date.
You're absolutely right. And Burlington Northern, even though it was decided a while back, is still relevant today. It shows how important it is to understand that delicate balance between state and federal authority in our legal system.
Speaking of Burlington Northern, I'm kind of curious about something. We mentioned earlier that they claimed the Alabama law was unconstitutional.
Right.
Why didn't the Supreme Court deal with those arguments directly? Was it a strategic move to avoid a potentially controversial issue?
That's a great question. And it reflects a bigger pattern in how the Supreme Court does things. They often try to avoid deciding on constitutional issues if they can settle the case using other reasons.
So they take the path of least resistance, avoiding a constitutional showdown if there's an easier solution.
Pretty much. In Burlington Northern, they found a clear conflict between the state and federal rules, and they used Hannah v. Plumer to fix it. They didn't need to get into the messy world of constitutional law to make a decision.
Yeah, makes sense. Why open a whole new can of worms if you can solve the problem with the tools you already have, right? It's about being efficient and not overstepping boundaries.
Exactly. The Supreme Court only wants to deal with constitutional questions when they absolutely have to. In this case, they found a nice and clean solution by interpreting the laws and procedural rules.
It's all about finding the best way to solve legal problems
Right.
while still being fair and just.
Absolutely. And Burlington Northern is a perfect example of how the Supreme Court handles these tricky legal situations to make sure that our justice system is both fair and consistent. It's a carefully planned out legal dance, wouldn't you say?
A dance with some pretty high stakes. But that's what makes our legal system so interesting, right? It's constantly changing to meet new challenges and make sure that justice wins in the end. You know, as we're wrapping up our deep dive into Burlington Northern Railroad v. Woods, I can't help but think about what this all means for, like, lawyers in the real world, especially those who might have cases that end up in federal court. This decision feels like it could really change the game, don't you think?
It really does. This case sends a very clear message to lawyers. When you're in federal court, you got to be ready for federal procedural rules to take over, even if a state law seems like it should apply. You really need to do your research and see if there's a federal rule that already covers the issue. It's like you need to look at the case with two sets of legal glasses, one for state law and one for federal law.
That makes a lot of sense. It really highlights how important it is to know both state and federal law, especially for those lawyers who are dealing with cases that could, you know, cross those jurisdictional lines. Sounds like it could be a real pain, but maybe also a chance for, like, really skilled lawyers to use these rules to their advantage.
Absolutely. A lawyer who really understands these nuances can use them to help their client and navigate all the complexities to get the best possible result.
So Burlington Northern is more than just a theoretical legal lesson. It's a practical guide for litigation strategy. It's not just about knowing the law, it's about understanding how these different legal systems work together and using that knowledge to your advantage.
Exactly. It's like playing chess. You need to think ahead, anticipate your opponent's moves, and come up with a strategy that considers all the rules and potential traps. And in this case, Burlington Northern gives lawyers a valuable roadmap, especially when they're dealing with diversity jurisdiction cases.
So as we wrap up this fascinating discussion, I'm curious about the lasting impact of Burlington Northern. I mean, it's decided way back in the 1980s. Are its core principles still relevant today? Or has the legal landscape changed so much that it's no longer applicable?
That's a really insightful question. And even though things are always changing in the legal world, the fundamental principles of Burlington Northern are surprisingly still very relevant today. The idea that federal procedural rules generally win out over conflicting state rules in federal court remains a cornerstone of our legal system. This case is still influential, shaping legal thinking and practice even decades later.
It really goes to show that legal knowledge isn't just about memorizing a bunch of rules. It's about understanding the history and how legal principles have developed over time. It's about seeing the connections between different cases and legal ideas and realizing that the law is like this complex tapestry. And, you know, Burlington Northern Railroad v. Woods has been our guide through a particularly interesting part of that tapestry.
It's been a real pleasure to unpack all of this with you and our listeners, and I think we've shed some light on the case's lasting impact. It's amazing how seemingly simple cases can have such big effects on the balance of power between state and federal courts.
So, as we're finishing up our deep dive into Burlington Northern Railroad v. Woods, what's the one key takeaway you'd like our listeners to walk away with?
I think the biggest thing is that the relationship between state and federal law is always changing and evolving. Understanding how they interact is super important for anyone involved in the legal world, whether you're a seasoned lawyer or a law student just starting out.
This case really highlights how the legal world is full of intricate connections and subtle nuances. We hope everyone keeps exploring, keeps asking questions, and keeps those legal minds active and engaged.
Absolutely. Until next time, keep exploring the fascinating world of law.